football fans, and welcome to Thursday Sportsnet Soccer Central podcast. James Sharman there alongside John Molinaro. A busy show today. Later today, we'll talk to our good friend Ben Rycroft about the latest match-fixing fiasco in Canadian soccer. He wrote a great column on Vice.com about this subject, and it's quite staggering. We'll get to that in some detail in the next little while. We'll peruse the big stories around the football world, but we'll start today with some talk about my favourite sports tournament in the world, the FA Cup.
You do love the FA Cup.
I love the FA Cup. I grew up on the FA Cup when it was something really special.
Right.
When, you know, that Saturday at Wembley, it was like the Super Bowl of English sports. You know, right. You'd get up early and they'd follow the bus through the streets of London. It was amazing. Plus, my team, Liverpool, was winning pretty much every single year.
Now, did coverage start in the morning? Like, was it all day?
It was, yeah. Okay.
So it's kind of like the Super Bowl,
Grandstand
over the top.
Was the show in England on the BBC. Yeah. And Des Lynam would be the guy hosting it. It was brilliant. A man that knows a lot about the FA Cup. He's played in it many, many times. Has some huge games, in fact, himself, in the FA Cup. Is our good friend, Danny Dicchio. Deitch, welcome to the podcast.
How are we doing, guys? You okay?
We're doing excellent. Excellent. I'm pumped, mate. Now, listen, fans love this thing, right? We always love it, and we have that romance of the cup kind of feel to it. As a player, as a footballer, it's January. You're in the midst of the Premier League season. It's just after the festive period, and then, boom, the third round comes around. And if you're in the Premier League, you haven't donned your FA Cup boots. Are you loving it as much as the fans, or is it a bit of a drag at this time of the year?
Well, to be quite honest, Shams, it all depends on who you've been drawn against as well. And especially if you're a Premier League team or a top championship team and you've been drawn against a non-league team or a lower League 2 team, then you're kind of the writing's on the wall for an upset, or you're kind of going into a game where it's a no-win situation. But for me, as you said, growing up as a kid, the FA Cup is one of the biggest tournaments, the most prestigious tournaments that every kid wants to play in. And as a player, I actually really look forward to it.
Both you and James mentioned there the history and the prestige of the tournament. I'm wondering, Danny, though, that, you know, over the last 10 years, you know, with managers rotating their squad so much and very much fielding B teams, has it lost its luster at all? I mean, does it still matter, I guess, is what I'm asking?
I think... you're right, John. I think it's been kind of devalued as such by certain managers. But I think that centres around the amount of money that's involved with the game now, with either staying in the Premier League and by the top teams in the Premier League, where they're trying to get into the Champions League spots and they want their best players available for that. So putting them into a risky FA Cup tie where you're playing at a lower league team, where it's their cup final, even in the third round, every smaller team is their cup final playing against the big teams. And I just feel that the managers now, it's a risky situation, because they don't want their top players injured, and they kind of devalue it as such, where they're going to put out some of their fringe players or bring some of their younger players into the third round and hopefully get them through. We've seen Arsene Wenger do it in recent years, and I think that's kind of devalued it. And it, also the television rights has kind of swayed a little bit. It used to be on all weekend with on all three channels that we have in England, whether it be BBC One, ITV, the two main channels that we had growing up, and now even Sky Sports is a major cable provider, which shows a lot of games. But I just think it's kind of not as open or as sexy as it used to be back in the day when we were younger. Everyone wanted to play in the FA Cup. Everyone wanted to go to the FA Cup games. It was always early in the new year, so it's always exciting times.
I wonder too, Danny, I'd love to get your perspective on this, because, you know, as football fans, we love, you know, the festive period of the Premier League, because there's games every 3 days.
Yeah.
You know, there's the Boxing Day, then again on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, then their first game in early January, then, you know, they have to play this third round FA Cup. So for fans of the game, it's great. I wonder, though, when during your days playing, I mean, what was it like for the players to go through that heavy stretch of games in such a short period of time? It's got to be grueling.
Well, it's really a whirlwind, to be quite honest, John, and you're just hoping that you can get through it. It's always a stressful time, not only for managers, for players as well, because it's where a lot of injuries kind of mount up, and you're kind of running on fumes by the third or fourth game over the festive period. So that's when you see a lot of cup upsets early in the new year, where a lot of players have gone through a grueling stage of the season, and you're coming up against a non-league team in the FA Cup or a lower league team that they're all chomping at the bit to get at these prima donnas in the Premier League. And it's a real strange time, because obviously the festive period, you want to spend a lot of time with your family and your close friends, and you don't get to do a lot of that as a player. But I did used to like playing at Christmas, because there was also some exciting games where there was a lot of topsy-turvy results, have we seen recently in the Premier League, where players are kind of got their heads, their minds elsewhere. And I used to enjoy it myself. And even as a fan growing up, you just had game after game. I remember used to travel into away games as well, and everyone was in a festive spirit.
Of course, back in those days, you could booze it up right the night before and no one cared. Nowadays, you go and do it so much. I'm not aging you that much, Deitch, but you kind of mentioned it there in the FA Cup. When you were playing for a big club, speak Sunderland or a West Brom, and you're heading to some, small, maybe semi-pro team, who knows, but in the lower divisions, were you always aware that, from a talent standpoint, you can beat these guys, but you knew that physically they're going to try and put a beating on you? Were they ever intimidated, or was it purely like, they were up for the challenge?
I think it was a bit of both, to be quite honest, Shams, and it depended as well whether you were drawn away from home or whether you were drawn at home. If you were drawn at home, I used to think that was even worse, because, as you said, you're on a hiding for nothing, because you're playing in front of your own fans. You're expected to trounce these lower league teams by at least 3 or 4 nil. And if you don't get those 3 or 4 goals where everyone wants to be entertained, you get booed off the pitch anyway. Now, if the lower league team come to your place and actually put in a good performance and actually take you right till the last minute, which I've had before as well, you're getting slaughtered in the press the next day for even nicking a 1-0 win. So I think going away from home, it's more on their foot, where they have to try and perform in front of their own fans, get in your faces. I've been to grounds before where we saw groundsmen watering the field on a snowy, icy day because they wanted the pitch of field as bad as possible for these prima donnas coming in with their beautiful shiny boots and beautiful kit. And these guys were wearing probably the same boots and kit that they've been wearing all year. No substitute kits for them. So it was a real eye-opener, but I thought that kind of brought the romance of the FA Cup as well, where you were going to these non-league grounds where you would never, ever play before, and you were playing against players that had watched you on TV or looked up to you as a young fan, and now they're playing against you and they're trying to kick 7 bells out of you.
Yeah, probably how Arsenal are feeling taking on Sunderland this weekend, right, Deitch? Like, very similar.
Especially as Big Sam has said that he's not putting out his full squad as well.
Ouch.
Ouch. So we got to talk about some famous Danny Dicchio moments here in FA Cup. I have to admit, I didn't know much about your record in the competition, but pretty impressive, Danny. The hat trick against Bradford City in the third round of, was it 2003, where you scored a hat trick in 19 minutes? What happened there?
Yeah, I don't. And I think, again, no surprise, the majority of them were with my head. But we worked on it the day before. I remember Gary Megson, the one of the best managers, not that I ever played for. he said that we need to put as many balls in the box as possible, because the two centre backs that I was playing against were pretty small. And I just remember at the end of the game, although I got my hat trick, I had a big ice pack on the top of my head, because I must have headed the ball at least 700 times during the game, because it was just an arsenal of crosses coming into the box frequently, and I just thought, Jesus Christ, this is not good football to watch. But I got my hat trick, and that was happy days. We went pretty far that year in the FA Cup, so it was good memories from West Brom for sure.
And then another sort of match report that I stumbled across upon was when you were at Preston against Crystal Palace. You scored an 87th minute winner off of Paul McKenna free kick. What were your memories of that one?
that was actually one of my first goals for Preston. The year before, I joined Preston, and this new thing that they brought out in the Premier League now, assist. I assisted about 17 goals, but I never scored in my first year, and it kind of played on my mind. So I remember the replay that was Crystal Palace. We tied against them at home, and then the replay was a dark and murky Wednesday night down in South London at Selhurst Park, and I managed to get my first goal for Preston. I think I scored two that day. It was a late winner,
yeah,
header from a free kick, and I was just delighted to get off the mark for Preston. But obviously set up a lot of goals, but didn't get a lot of goals in my first year. So I was happy. We went on a decent run that year. I think we ended up playing Man City at home that year as well in the quarterfinals. So it was a good run again.
Right. And then obviously there's been disappointment with you in the FA Cup in terms of when you were at Millwall, the year,
yes,
that they reached the final against Man United with, I think it was 2006, if I'm remembering it correctly. But you were suspended for the final. And reading the match report here, it says, the former QPR and Sunderland forward was dismissed after an off-the-ball clash with Nottingham Forest defender Wes Morgan. What happened there, buddy?
His fault, right?
Well, thanks for bringing that up, gentlemen.
No problem.
One of the darkest moments in my career. but no, we had a fantastic run that year with Mill. Dennis Wise, Tim Cahill were in the team as well. And we had a young, bubbly team who managed to get the luck of the draw. We'd had a couple of tricky ties. I remember we had Tranmere early on. We had a away trip at Telford on the midweek as well. That was a horrible, horrible game, but we squeaked out that one. Then we had Sunderland in the semi-final, my ex-team, and we won that at Old Trafford. But in a league game, I came up against Nottingham Forest and Wes Morgan, who's now the captain of Leicester City. There was a off-the-ball challenge where either he caught me with an elbow or I had a flailing arm and caught him with elbow, and we both
very diplomatic.
Yeah,
we both threw our handbags at each other, had a little scuffle, and the referee sent us off. And unfortunately, even though it was a league game, I still got suspended for the final. And on a darker note, I actually thought about quitting the game because, I said earlier on in the interview, that it's every young boy's dream to play in the FA Cup, and the referee didn't even have a look at my appeal, and even Wes Morgan come out and said it was nothing, it was handbags, there was no punches thrown or anything, but the referee refused to look at it. And once the referee refuses to look at the appeal, then the suspension stands, and I was out for three games, including the FA Cup final.
That's just awful, I can imagine. How hard is it in that situation to be positive and cheer on your team and even watch the final and be positive? It can't be easy.
It wasn't easy at all. Even the preparation the week before, I was on the training field and going through the motions as such. We were going through some systems of play and just matching up against Man United, who Mill were playing in the final. And I was meant to be Ruud van Nistelrooy up top, and we were just doing matchups against certain players. And I just had to walk off the field one training session and said to Ray Wilkins, who I grew up with at QPR, I said, look, I need to get away for a couple of days. And they actually said, look, just get yourself away. And I went to nice Dubai for two or three days to try and get my head out of it. And that's when I was really actually pretty down. And I thought, I don't want to continue playing no more.
Well, but that's you soon changed your mind, though, obviously. How long did it take to clear?
Well, even the final was pretty bad, you know, going to the final knowing that you weren't going to play. But it was a difficult game, as we knew it was going to be. It was more of the occasion that I missed out on. I didn't want any of my family there as well. I refused to have them at the game. And it was just a moment of time that I really kind of thought would pass over quickly, but it didn't. And it still etches away a little bit now, because it wasn't so much the altercation with Wes Morgan, who I don't blame at all. It's more the referee and the FA for not actually even looking at the appeal and, you know, taking away a boyhood dream of playing in the FA Cup final. But I kind of carried on for a year, and then I said, look, I've got to move on from Millwall. They've changed their managers and stuff. I need to get a fresh approach to see if I can get that love of the game back again. And I went to Preston, and then obviously two and a half years at Preston, followed up by moving out here to Toronto.
And it all worked out beautifully. and your shining smile lit up BMO Field.
At the end, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
It did. Deej, thanks so much, mate. Enjoy the games this weekend. Try not to, think back too much on that fateful night. Thanks, mate.
All right, guys.
We'll chat soon.
No worries.
Cheers.
That was Danny Dicchio. Great story. Sad
great
story. You can imagine how you must crush a player, and especially before the final.
Yeah.
I remember reading Roy Keane's biography, 99 Champions League in the semi-final against Juventus.
Right.
He got, I think it's a yellow card. Was it a red card? And regardless, he missed the final.
I think it was a yellow card again.
Yeah, he missed the final. And how that was his chance, his moment, you know, in the European stage, and didn't get to really carry that out. And
after playing such a pivotal role in helping them get to that point.
Yeah, absolutely. And to play Bayern Munich without Roy Keane that year, I mean, wow, that was a challenge in itself, which even adds more legend to that United team of 1999.
Right. Interesting. I didn't know that about Danny, about... After being suspended for the game, man, it sounds like he kind of struggled with.
He still is.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, he's still obviously emotional. Like, you know, he's not carried it very well. And I understand that.
Right. Interesting.
Tough. But a wonderful tournament. And the games begin on Sportsnet World on Friday with Liverpool against Exeter City. And then a slew of games on Saturday and Sunday. Check out sportsnet.ca for the schedule.
Leicester and Tottenham on Sunday should be good.
Interesting one. I wonder what kind of teams are being put out, because they're playing each other too the next week in the Premier League.
Yeah.
So it's a few days later, actually.
And then they now is that the game, midweek game next week?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay, so yeah. I gotta think that they're gonna, both teams will rotate to a certain degree.
Oh, we're gonna have to, right? I mean, Leicester's got some injury concerns. Vardy's out for this.
Right.
Having minor groin surgery. And Spurs have a big enough squad. They're going to rest some players. They've got bigger fish to fry.
Right.
Which is sad to say. I wonder, I said it for a long time now, if you want to get some more prestige back behind the FA Cup, do you give a Champions League berth to the winner?
No.
You don't? Why?
Well, if you want to add more prestige to the tournament, sure. I don't think the FA Cup, I would make the argument the FA Cup winner shouldn't get a Champions League.
Really? Yeah. I would love to see it, personally. Now, often it's a top four or three club anywhere that wins it.
Right.
So that obviously causes issue, in which case it goes to the fourth place team, I think, in the league. And there's no way the Premier League would agree to losing a berth to the FA Cup. And I understand the logistics involved here, but I would love to see that. I think the FA Cup would once again mean something.
But then you know that the Spain is going to, you know, does the Copa del Rey winner get like...
Well, that's up to them.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's up to them. Yeah, you still have four berths if you're England or Spain.
So take the one berth away.
Yeah, you decide how you allocate those berths, right? And say you decide three berths from the Premier League and the FA Cup when it gets the qualifying round berth.
Right.
Right? I just think I've always thought that'd be a great way to add more prestige, make it important once again.
Well, you correct me if I'm wrong, don't they get a Europa League berth now?
Yeah.
Like that's the FA Cup winner, right?
Yeah, that's right, because it's a fifth place in the Premier League and that.
I don't know. I don't like the idea of handing a Champions League berth to a cup winner.
I think it makes the importance of that tournament greater. But it will never happen, sadly.
No.
There's no point discussing it, which we have just done.
So good for you for bringing it up.
Anytime. Some news to get to before we get to Ben Rycroft. Jermaine Genus retires today.
Did he really?
I thought he had retired.
Wow.
Finally.
Where's he been?
He's been doing media, right? He works for the Premier League. Does a really good job as a pundit, actually. Really well spoken. Speaks his mind. But we're still trying to come back from that knee injury.
Right.
Never happened. And talk about a player who started off so well in his career.
Yeah,
young hope for England. Played well for Newcastle and Spurs when he was healthy. And then, was it Villa as well he went to? West Ham? I could be wrong.
That doesn't sound familiar.
But regardless, a really good young talent, but not obviously able to play a full career.
He's got
to
be...
numerous knee injuries.
How old is he?
Let me find that out for you.
He can't be... I wouldn't think he's, I don't know.
Give me a second here. I'm going to Wikipedia it, because that's never, ever wrong about anything.
No, of course not.
Jermaine Genus. But yeah, so he's out, and I imagine he'll get a good opportunity on the TV somewhere, because like I said, he's well-spoken, camera, and he says what he thinks, so which is pretty rare in any kind of sport.
So kind of like Jamie Redknapp in that way.
Yeah, exactly. And also a guy that was really injury-prone in his career.
Oh, absolutely.
There's
probably
some big comparisons there.
Yeah.
I think you could probably say Redknapp was more accomplished in his career.
Than Jermaine Genus?
Genus was on loan at Villa in 2011.
Okay.
Then he was Forest for a year on loan as well, 2012, 2013. And at QPR, 13 to 14, 38 appearances, because he made his name really at Newcastle
right.
and Spurs. where he played almost 300 games combined.
So what's the answer to the question? How old is he?
Oh, my God, he's 32.
Oh, really?
Holy
See, I wouldn't have thought that. Wow.
Me neither. I would have said barely 30.
Yeah, I would have said 29,
yeah.
30 maybe.
He's 32.
Okay,
wow.
But not that 32 is old, but no, it just seems like a babe in the woods.
You've got those knees. He's got knees of a 42-year-old.
Yeah.
Sure. Yanezai's back to United from his loan deal at
never Borussia caught Dortmund. On at Dortmund.
Six games he played there as a sub, essentially.
Yeah. So how does he fit in at United now? How do you see that?
Well, it's not as if they need a creative force, is it?
No.
Yeah, he was so poor after his initial breakthrough. I don't know if he's going to fit into a Louis van Gaal system at all. Do you?
Tough to see. I mean, I don't know. I raised the question, like, where does he fit in, like, tactically in this formation? Like, where does he fit in? And who loses their place?
Yeah, well, precisely. Well, it's not as if that anyone's owning a spot there right now.
Right.
Right? But with Memphis Depay, at some point you'd figure going to find his game and get some more playing time.
Well, you would think.
I don't know. You know what I like about United right now?
What?
The one thing I like about United is seeing Ashley Young finally getting a chance under Van Gaal and actually doing some good things, playing in the right position.
Right.
He's playing great. Last time out against Swansea, outstanding.
Yeah. You know who I've been quite impressed with is Smalling.
Oh,
I think he's
player of the year for him.
For United.
Well, for Spurs, yeah. For United, sorry. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. No, I think he's really developed into a solid center back. And, you know, so both a big asset for both United and for England.
I would put him in the England starting 11.
Oh, I would. 100%. Absolutely. Yeah.
100% he'd be there.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's played very well. Also taking the captain's armband as well.
Yeah, which is a big, considering, you know, his, you know, well, he hasn't been there all that long, but.
You'd be surprised, actually. I mean, he came over from Fulham, right?
And when he did, but I just want to say, like, last year was when
he
really
started. There. I'm going to say he's been there for 5 years.
Has it been that long?
I'm going to guess. Let's have a look here, shall we? The wiki machine. Wow. He joined United in 2010.
Okay. I didn't think it was then. All right.
Wow.
Fair enough.
Yep, I had a great couple of years. Great year, sorry, at Fulham. Didn't play very much.
I remember at Fulham, he was great.
Really was showing. Maidstone United actually came from. That's a local team near where I grew up, actually.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, and numerous injuries slowed him down
right.
for most of his career, really.
Yeah.
So many injuries, but he's been healthy this year, and he's a technical center back, which.
Very smart. Very good on the ball. So I've been quite impressed with him. So good for him.
Alan Curtis has just come down now, actually. Breaking news. Alan Curtis named. Manager of Swansea for the remainder of the season.
Wow.
So much for the Marcelo Bielsa rumors, eh?
Yeah, I wonder if that's... I suppose that's a more matter of no one wants to take that job right now.
Could well be right, actually, yeah. And he says, he says, I don't want the job. He doesn't want it
full-time.
Really,
full-time? He's been there for like 50 years or something
like that. Exactly. Right? It's a bit of a John Carver situation, right?
No, that's a good comparison. That's a very good comparison.
Hope it works out for him better than it did for JC.
Yeah. I hope it works out for Swansea. I quite, you know, a few years ago when they were playing under...
Gary, Loudrop.
Loudrop. I thought they were a fantastic team. They were very fun to watch.
They were under Monk as well, up until about, six games into this season.
Yeah.
So sad, because, I mean, last year was a record finish, I think, for Swansea.
Yeah.
I think they finished eighth. Put on my notes here.
Won the league cup a few
Swansea
years.
Swansea finished eighth last year, yeah.
Yeah, won the league cup a few years ago.
Yeah.
So they were
really good.
Entertaining to watch.
Went down the toilet this year, sadly. Jonathan Guzman played there, of course.
He did.
For a year. Did very well. Liked it there. He was on loan from, I think, Villarreal at the time.
I think that's correct.
Right. And then I know he wanted to stay there, which I believe he did. And then they couldn't work out a deal with Villarreal. And then he ended up in Napoli for the last couple of years. This year he hasn't played once. Now, I interviewed Jonathan, and it's on the site right now.
It is on sportsnet.ca. Yep.
De Guzman is obviously such a polarizing figure in Canadian soccer circles. The hardcore fans don't like him. They think he's busy a pariah. You know, he didn't play for Canada, played for the Netherlands instead. So we talk about that in this interview, and he talks about how he still is first and foremost Canadian, loves his country. He's back holding a camp over Christmas. He'll probably end up here. And despite his professional career choices, which he explains in detail in the interview, yet despite that, we still get people hammering on him and on us for airing the interview.
Mm.
Get a life, people. Get over this. You have to get over this. It's sport. And if you actually listen to the interview, you'll hear from what he says, and what he says makes a lot of sense, okay? He does love Canada. He's allowed to love Canada, even if he didn't play for Canada. We need to put a line under it. And move forward. We really do. But people still hold this resentment against it. I'm just I know. Just sport people.
It seemed to be a lot of people were missing the point of the video too, in that like he's back here in Canada giving back, and that he's running these soccer camps to help develop local talent. So I mean, I would think that would be something that, you know, people would get behind and celebrate. But
people are talking as if he's, you know, as we discussed off camera,
a traitor.
A traitor, yeah. Someone who's sold state secrets to the Russians.
Right. It's and I get it. I get people that are, you know, upset that he didn't play for Canada, but the vitriol.
It's the vitriol. Yeah.
I mean,
okay, I understand the resentment. I get that. That's fine. But some of the language you use, tone it down, people.
Yeah.
Get a life.
He didn't kill anyone.
No. As far as we know.
Well, yeah, I shouldn't say.
Yeah. We assume he hasn't killed anyone.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Was he a good guy?
Great guy. I've spoken to Jonathan number
of
times.
Yeah, you have. You talked to him, right?
He's a great guy, yeah. And genuinely really enjoys coaching. He's back, you know. He brought his kid over and had 50 or 60-year-old kids, and watching them train, they were loving every second of it. They really were. And he really wants to bring back and give to this country.
Do you get a sense that coaching might one day be in his future?
I think so. I mean, this is really his first go at it. And he was saying how much he's enjoying it. Maybe he's not 30 yet, right? He's still young.
He's a young man.
And he hasn't played this year. He's got an injury. He might be moving, though, in the window. His agent said this past week, actually, that there's a good chance he'll move somewhere, be it on loan or otherwise. Because, obviously, it's not a future at Napoli for him. So he's still got, obviously, his playing career is front and foremost. But I think coaching, who knows, maybe.
Yeah, good for him.
Oh, JMO, quickly breaking news here. AP Sports are reporting that suspended UEFA president Michel Platini tells the Associated Press he is withdrawing from the FIFA presidential election.
Oh, wow.
No. Really? Wow, I didn't see that coming.
Not a surprise.
God. Corruption in sports. Segway.
Yes. Very good.
We're now joined by a man that knows all about corruption in sport. Good friend of the podcast. It's Ben Rycroft. Hey, Ben.
Hey, guys. How are you today?
Doing great, thanks. Once again, Ben, you've been causing some issues for organized crime.
Yeah, I seem to keep sticking my nose into their business.
You do. If you haven't seen it, I will tweet out again later today at James Sharman. Ben wrote a great piece, revealing piece on Vice.com about corruption and match fixing in Canadian soccer, in particular the CSL, and one specific match between Niagara United and SC Waterloo. Now, this has been going on for a long time. Ben's written about this before. He's produced a great TV segment on CBC in the past as well. But Ben, can you quickly just describe what happened in this match?
Well, the long and short of it was one of the teams, Niagara United, who was playing SC Waterloo, became aware or became suspicious that the game that they were in was being fixed by their opponent. They tried a couple different things, and obviously throughout the game they were seeing certain things that were standing out for them. Namely, in their words, one of the SC Waterloo players refused to score on an open net, rounded the keeper, kicked it out of bounds, refused to go forward. And then as the game got progressively weirder, Niagara basically turned the tables on them and decided that they were going to try and score on their own net to ruin the fix, at which point SC Waterloo then stopped two of those opportunities, blocking it one time and blocking it a second time. Before the referee called the match at the 65th minute. In terms of weird stories that I've heard come out of the CSL, this is certainly up there. It's definitely one of the weirder stories I've ever come across in terms of match fixing, and certainly regarding the CSL. And it's kind of shocking to me that it's gotten to this point, that we've allowed it to get to this point in terms of law enforcement not intervening, not doing anything, and we're watching it accelerate, from what I understand, when it regards to match fixing in this league.
Now, the CSL is no longer sanctioned by the CSA, correct, after previous indiscretions?
Yeah, it's technically a private league, similar to what I guess the NHL would be. It's governed by itself, and so there's no real oversight. Being an unsanctioned league, though, I mean, it's not a whole lot different than what it was previously. They basically operate on their own, and it's their own responsibilities. So it's, if anything, I kind of look back on what my reporting has done, and in a lot of ways, I think that it's sort of sent up a flag to organized crime that this was, that this was going to be open season. There has been no investigation, or there's been no, there have been police investigations. There's been no action taken by law enforcement up until this point. We're aware that the OPP and the RCMP have both investigated but have not done anything. And so as a result of my reporting, it has somewhat sent up a flag, I think, to organized crime that it's open season in Ontario when it comes to organized crime, that we're not going to prosecute the types of things that we're seeing going on in this league.
So you're actually promoting organized crime then, in that case.
Good job, Ben.
Yeah, boy, you're
yeah, you know,
sponsored
the
by
best of intentions, the worst of results, unfortunately.
Well, you mentioned in the piece Declan Hill, who we know very well, of course, here, calls the law enforcement a bunch of gutless wimps. He says it twice, in fact. Do they just not care because it's soccer, because it's an unsanctioned league? I mean, what is the reason for their malaise?
I think it's a couple things, and this is based on talking to people at the OPP and also local law enforcement. It comes down to priorities, political priorities. I think I was fairly naive when I entered into this investigation back in 2011. My expectation was if a crime has taken place, law enforcement will investigate. If there's enough evidence, they will then take it to the prosecutor, and there will be a trial. And from what I've learned as a result of my investigations, that's obviously not the case. We've seen that it basically comes down to political leanings and what is sort of the hot topic of the day. And from what they told me pretty bluntly is that if it doesn't involve drugs, terrorism, or the trafficking of women, when it comes to major crimes in this province, there simply isn't the resources to go ahead and investigate. So it's not a matter that they don't care. And I've talked to investigators throughout this process that they do care and they do see that it's a problem. But one person or two people can't be put onto something like this and expected to turn about a result. There needs to be actual money put behind it. There needs to be actual resources put behind it for there to be any kind of result that we would like to see. And it's frustrating from the journalistic point of view because we're all cognizant that this is going on. Law enforcement is aware that it's going on. They've been in the loop with a number of the reports that have come out from Interpol, the ICSS, the International Center for Sports Security. So they have the data. They have the information the same way that we do, but we've yet to see anything in terms of any real action, and that comes back to those three directives. If it doesn't fall into that realm, they're simply not going to put money behind it. And for me, as I said, I was fairly naive entering into this process, thinking that if a crime is being committed, law enforcement will go out there and they'll do something about it. But that's simply not the case. And it's been a frustrating process on that front.
I think one of the things that was most compelling about the story, your story on Vice Sports, Ben, was that you were able to get, you know, a number of players and coaches by name, you know, to talk about this. I'm wondering how hard was it for you as a reporter to get these guys to go on the record to talk about this?
Well, they came to me initially, and I think it's born out of frustration. The amount of people who are aware of what's going on in that league is actually fairly small. There are, I would estimate, 5 or 6 teams who are actively involved in the alleged fixing, and then the rest of them sort of live in this, I would say, gray area, but it's becoming increasingly more black and white as we've seen these groups become more aggressive and more obvious with their attempts. So if you think about it in the context, you're playing in a game and you get by a guy really easily, like, is it because you were just really good on that play or was that guy letting you go? That's kind of vague. But when you start to see stuff like what we've seen with this last game and FC Waterloo blocking their opponents from scoring in their own nets, it's no longer sort of gray area. It's very black and white. And I think that's now resulting in a frustration level because for a lot of these guys, I mean, they don't want to play rec league soccer yet. They still want to play at like a high level. And for them in their areas, this might be the only competition that they're able to get into. So as they become more aware, I think that we'll see more people coming forward and speaking out about it simply out of frustration. And I don't blame them because, you know, it's insulting and it ruins your own reputation when you stand next to this sort of stuff going on, even if you're not involved in it. By playing in that league or playing for those teams, you're basically being lumped in with them. And it's not always fair for a number of these teams. I'm not excusing sort of the malaise that has existed on the administration side of things there. They should have done stuff a long time ago, and they haven't. They've buried their heads in the sand. But from a player perspective, I can very much see as this continues to, and I do expect it to get worse before it gets better, as it continues to get worse. From 2009, where the first game was allegedly fixed by this group, to now, where we're seeing that it's up to 42% of the games. That's a massive increase, and we can see now that they're becoming more aggressive and more bold. So I'm hoping that as a result of this, they will begin to, players will become to be more emboldened and speak out more.
What's been the response from the Canadian Soccer League just to all these allegations and to your reporting of this story?
They largely ignore me. I didn't actually get the press release, John, until you sent it to me the other day.
Right.
They're not, for a long time, I think that they wanted to ignore what was going on and sort of lay it at my feet. They thought that my reporting was somehow disingenuous. They took out a full page ad in a magazine to basically slander my reporting, which after the fact, about 3 months later, they would admit that it was true what I was reporting. So I think from the CSL side of things, they've finally come around to the realization that this isn't just me saying this now. It's Interpol, it's the ICSS, it's international policing, and it's the local police forces as well. So to their credit, at least they've sort of woken up to the reality. And to their discredit, it's taken them this long. I mean, if they had come about 3 years ago when this was first reported in 2012. And decided to do something about it instead of trying to lay the blame at my feet, I think they'd be in a much better situation than they are now. But they've sowed their own seeds in that result, and so now we're seeing the result of their ignorance over those years, and it's gotten to the point it is. And it's the type of thing that, you know, if you'd done something when it initially came out, you might have been able to stop it, but now it's gotten to the point where it's become so aggressive and law enforcement is still not doing anything. Until law enforcement gets involved, I can't see any change happening.
Is it naive, Ben, to think that it's just soccer being affected by this in this country? I mean, God forbid hockey's affected, but I mean, why not at this point?
I actually think of it in this is now a Canadian sport issue. My belief is that the Canadian Soccer League is the canary in the coal mine. We haven't seen it yet, but there is absolutely, if you look across the spectrum of sport in this country, there is a number of leagues that would be considered vulnerable. Outside of professional baseball, professional hockey, and professional basketball, if you look across the spectrum, whether it's CIS, Development League basketball, the CFL, Development League soccer, there's a number of these leagues where these players aren't making very much money, and that immediately makes them vulnerable, and that immediately makes them targets. And as I've said, because law enforcement hasn't done anything when it comes to this league, it is, I've very much sent up a flag to the organized crime groups that this is, Ontario is open for business. Canada is very much weak when it comes to match fixing and organized crime. So for me, I'm now thinking of this as a much larger spectrum when it comes to Canadian sport. I think that there are a number of vulnerable leagues. And as I've been saying, if law enforcement doesn't take this issue now seriously, we're going to see this, I believe, expand beyond Canadian soccer and Canadian Soccer League and go into other realms. Just from looking very, very quickly, you can identify a number of these sports that do have betting lines on them. And these athletes aren't making very much money. They're not able to have careers because they're putting their lives into this. They work part-time jobs. They're just getting by. And a lot of the same factors that I saw in 2010 to 2012 with the Canadian Soccer League, a lot of those factors exist here. Vulnerability of athletes is a major issue. And because of the lack of action on the part of law enforcement and some of the sort of irregularities in our legal system that doesn't define what match fixing is, and there are some large loopholes when it comes to fraud, and obviously, as I said, the lack of political interest, all of those things are sort of building into what I would describe as a perfect storm. And I think that we need to start thinking of this as larger than just the Canadian Soccer League, that this is an issue for Canadian sport to begin to take seriously.
Well, it's thankless work, I know, Ben, but we are very appreciative that yourself and Declan Hill, of course, are so involved. Keep up the good work, mates, and we'll chat to you real soon.
Thanks, guys.
That is Ben Rycroft. You can follow Ben on Twitter at Benjamin Rycroft. And I will retweet the Vice column shortly because you have to read this.
It's a good read.
Incredible stuff. It really is. And as you'll see in the piece, the first time it's really first-hand witnesses explaining what happened. And suggesting what they think probably did happen. Well, JMO, we're out of time.
Yes.
Good show.
It was. You know, quickly, I want to just discuss something real quick about Ben, because and we didn't sort of touch on it, and I was going to ask him about this, but he kind of answered the question, because I think a lot of people will look at this and say, it's the Canadian Soccer League. Who cares? It's like a low-level league. Why does this matter? But then he kind of raised the issue about, you know, this bleeding into other sports and the potential that, you know, Canada could be open for business. So I think that's why it matters. I mean,
it's the sport, right? Is supposed to be able to avoid corruption. It's supposed to, the actual play on the field.
Regardless of the level.
Amateur sports is being affected by match fixing. My God.
Yeah.
I mean, what is the point?
Yeah.
Right? It's our sport, right? We love our sport. Just ask a few things from our sport. The main one of which is purity, right? And just the ability to see two teams face each other on equal footing.
Yeah.
Simple as that, right?
Yeah. So it's an interesting story and one that I'm sure Ben will continue to follow.
But sadly, as Ben alluded to, it might take a hockey scandal.
It might.
To actually get some political power behind it, because right now, soccer is still seen by so many at the upper levels of government as being this peripheral immigrant sport.
Yeah.
Wrong.
I wonder if it's that too. I mean, I'm sure it's that, but I also wonder just the fact that this is the CSL and that it's sort of like a, you know, it's a semi-pro league and that they might view it as it doesn't really matter. If this was like in the Ontario Hockey League or junior hockey or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I suspect that they would take a vastly different approach to this.
I 100% agree with you. Yeah. And, you know, it might be slowly seeping towards those levels as well.
Right. Could be.
Well, our thanks to Ben Rycroft. Our thanks to Danny Dicchio.
Yeah.
As mentioned, don't forget FA Cup throughout the weekend on Sportsnet World. I am back on Monday with Dobby and Dunlop. Yes, it's the much belated Christmas quiz edition. It's a little bit late, but it's going to be fun. I'm going to put those two boys on their spots. It should be fun, though. The listeners demanded it. That's why.
Okay. You
know, we had no time before Christmas.
Can you call it the Christmas quiz when it's like January?
We can call it whatever we want.
11th? Okay.
It's a podcast. We live by no rules.
That's fair enough. True.
All right, JMO. Thanks, pal. You can follow JMO on Twitter at John Molinaro, myself at James Sharman. Our thanks to all and sundry. Cheers for listening.